rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. Ted Kennedy's going to pull a trigger. Let me share the details with you of that in just a moment. 741 days, 11 hours, 50 minutes, 53 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. Barring impeachment or prosecution or imprisonment. Interesting, our Bush backwards clock here. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman with you, 7 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, all over the place. Tony Snow. Yes, I will get to Kennedy in just a second. Tony Snow. He says, well, Democrats, this is the headline from editor and publisher. And a tip of the hat, by the way, to the folks in the chat room for pointing this out to me. It's just amazing to me, the power of collective intelligence. I am convinced we have some of the most brilliant listeners in the nation to this program, and also the participants in our chat room. It's just a never-ending source of amazement to me. And thanks, you know, as I said, a tip of the hat. Thanks for pointing this out. The headline, editor and publisher, E&P, is basically the magazine for people in the news business. And, you know, it's not a partisan rag. It's very much not even down the middle. It's a trade publication. So the headline, Tony Snow, Democrats can cut off funds but can't stop president's surge. And they put surge in quotes. Deadline New York, at his briefing today, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow is naturally peppered with questions about President Bush's upcoming speech to the nation about his plan for, it seems to be an open secret, sending more U.S. troops to Iraq. Snow wouldn't quite admit that this was indeed set in stone, but sparred with reporters over why the president thinks the public will find this appealing. Snow held out hope that the Democrats would come to their senses about opposing this, but admitted it could even be a battle royale. But what about calls for the Democrats to halt the buildup by denying funding? Snow admitted Congress had funding control, but also pointed out that the president could ultimately do what he wants. Say what? He says, you know, the Congress has the power of the purse, but the president has the ability to exercise his own authority if he thinks Congress has voted the wrong way. I beg your pardon? Section 1, Article 1 of the Constitution. The second sentence of the Constitution, right? First, there's the preamble, you know, the we the people of the United States part. That's one long sentence. And then Article 1, Section 1, Article 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Period. End of sentence. Now, legislative powers, you know, can make laws, right? Legislative powers. They decide. I mean, this is not rocket science. Here's Tony Snow saying, no, the president has legislative powers. This is rather mind-boggling, shall we say, to the very least. Section 8. Of Article 1 of the Constitution. This is, again, the part of the Constitution that talks about the powers. It's called powers granted to Congress. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, to borrow money on the credit of the United States, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and the Indian tribes, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies, to coin money, to provide for punishment of counterfeiting, to establish post offices and post roads, promote the progress of science and the useful arts, to consult tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, to define and publish and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations. And here we get to Article 11, or Paragraph 11, and 12, and 13, and 14. And they're very straightforward. The Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. To make rules. Tony Snow says the president has the ability to exercise his own authority if he thinks Congress has voted the wrong way. No, I'm sorry. Read the Constitution, Mr. Snow! Obviously, George Bush has not. Paragraph 12, to raise and support armies. But no appropriation of money to that use shall be for longer term than 2 years. Now, that's a pretty important one, because here's, now we get to Ted Kennedy. Here's what Ted Kennedy is saying today. This is a news release from his office. He's talking about legislation that he intends to introduce that will, for the first time, demand accountability of President Bush's Iraq policy. And he pretty much lays it out. This, again, the language of Ted Kennedy's news release. The legislation requires the Congress to vote before the president escalates troop levels in Iraq. This is not rocket science. And Tony Snow can say all day long that Bush can do whatever he wants, but read the Constitution. As I said, paragraph 12, to raise and support armies. But no appropriation of money for that use should be longer term than 2 years. Well, it's been 2 years. And now the number 13, to provide and maintain a navy. Number 14, to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. This is the power of the legislature, not the president. Number 15, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Now, keep in mind, I am reading not the powers of the president. These are the powers of the House and the Senate. Number 16, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. That's essentially what's become the National Guard. Number 17, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 square miles as may by cessation of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States. That's Washington, D.C. And to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature in the state. Well, you could argue that we haven't purchased Iraq. And finally, number 18, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested in this Constitution, in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof. You get it? Only Congress has the power to make the laws. Period. Now, with regard to the president's military power, Section 2 of Article 2 says the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their representative offices. And he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States except in cases of impeachment. In other words, if Nixon had been impeached first, Ford couldn't have pardoned him. He shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present shall concur. And then it goes through that. And he can fill up vacancies. Doesn't say anywhere in here that he can make those decisions that just a minute ago I read to you Congress can make. So anyhow, Ted Kennedy says the legislation that he intends to send up to the Senate claims the people's right to a full voice of the president's plan to send more troops into the Iraq Civil War, It says that no funds can be spent to send additional troops to Iraq unless Congress approves the president's proposed escalation of American forces. President Bush should not be permitted to increase the number of United States troops in harm's way in the Civil War without a specific new authorization from Congress. Why? Well, he makes it very clear. He says the Iraq War Resolution of 2002 authorized a war against the regime of Saddam Hussein because he was believed to have weapons of mass destruction in a relationship with al-Qaeda. The mission of our armed forces today is no longer bears any resemblance to the mission authorized by Congress. Amen. Go for them, Ted Kennedy. Our number 440-8466. 440-THOM. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. 16 minutes past the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, the Tom Hartmann radio program. 1-866-440-8466. Coming up in the second hour of the program, we're going to actually talk to the real far left in the United States. Carl Dix is going to be with us, the national spokesperson for the Revolutionary Communist Party, in the second hour of our program. In the meantime, Harry Reid, he's going to look at it, doing everything within his power to wind down the war. Are the Democrats going to stand up to this? Congress wants to check Bush. Tony Snow, by the way, he says the midterm elections could not be read, or shouldn't be read, he's trying to argue this, as a mandate to cut forces in Iraq. But here's exactly what he said. He said, the president believes that if you take a look at the elections, you can read any number of messages. I mean, when people were asked in exit interviews what was their top concern, Iraq was number four. Corruption was number one. Yeah. A CNN poll shows only 16% of Americans think Bush should increase troops. Now, I realize governing by polls is not exactly what the founders had in mind, but 16% of us want this done? What is wrong with this picture? And the larger issue is you know, if, whether we want it done or not, is it going to be a disaster? Front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Neil King and Greg Jaffe writing, if Iraq worsens, allies see nightmare case. Now, this is not our word. This is not the Wall Street Journal's word. This is the word that's coming out of Jordan and Egypt and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Dateline Washington, as President Bush prepares to unveil his latest Iraq strategy, Arab allies are worried about what might happen if the plan fails. That worsening strife could engulf the entire region, sparking a wider war in the middle of the world's largest oil patch. The potential of a much larger regional conflict that pits Sunnis against Shiites is increasingly on the minds of both Arab leaders and U.S. military planners. Some are calling such a possible outcome the nightmare scenario. I guess, you know, George Bush wanted to be the president who would usher in the revelation. The four horsemen are riding, and he released them, I'm telling you. A wider conflict appeared, back to the Wall Street Journal, a wider conflict appears more plausible now. Because even as Iraq is separated along sectarian lines, regional dynamics are shoving neighboring nations into two rival camps. Now, what's causing this, by the way, is that on the one hand, you've got all these refugees. I mean, you've got a couple of million, literally a couple of million refugees from Iraq. And the Sunnis are fleeing to countries where they know that they'll have safe haven that are largely Sunni, and the Shia are fleeing to Shia countries, or countries where the Shia will have safe haven, and it's further radicalizing the area. Well, as the Wall Street Journal notes, on one side is a Shiite-led arc running from Iran into central Iraq through Syria and into Lebanon. On the other side lie American allies, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt, along with Persian Gulf states such as Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. These Sunni regimes are horrified at the emerging, increasingly radicalized Shiite bloc, largely financed and inspired by Iran, Arab diplomats say. In the middle is Iraq, which looks less and less like a buffer between these two axes of Middle Eastern power, and more like a no-man's land that is bringing them into conflict. And then they go on to point out, in the Wall Street Journal today, Arab countries are putting into place their own contingency plan in case Iraq begins to fall apart. The Saudis have warned the Bush administration that they're prepared to aid the Sunni militias in Iraq if the Sunni population there becomes imperiled, a Saudi diplomat said. Jordanian officials have told the Pentagon that they may move troops into Iraq's uninhabited western desert as a buffer if events there spiral out of control. The Turks say they're going to oppose any independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq. They've got their own problem with Kurds in Turkey and have for a long time. The Turks have been, in my opinion, oppressing the Kurds for, well, since day one, since the end of World War I, when the Ottoman Empire was ended and all this was carved up by the British. Even Syria, they note in the Wall Street Journal, which the U.S. alleges has been abetting the conflict, is expressing alarm over the potential fracturing of Iraq. As Imad Mustafa, the ambassador to the United States from Syria, said, and is quoted in today's Wall Street Journal, can you imagine the effect of Iraq breaking apart and each group looking for a regional or international power to support their territorial claims or their ethnic claims? The repercussions will be terrible, not just for Iraq, but for all the countries. This, they note in the Wall Street Journal, could push oil prices to more than $100 a barrel. Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Iran together hold about two-thirds of the world's proven oil reserves. The emergence of a large, oil-rich, and devoutly Shiite Arab state carved from Iraq's southern half with a government closely tied to Iran would radically alter the face of the Middle East and grant more leverage to Shiite leaders in Iran. And so, you know, are the Jordanians going to get in on this? Are the Saudis going to get in? I mean, this could be a disaster of epic proportions. We'll get into that, what Ted Kennedy's going to do, and your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cavalry was quiet except for the drilling in the wall. The captain had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. I just want to, not apropos of the whole Iraq war thing, but of this whole issue of progressive talk radio and, you know, finding a viable financial model and everything. It's a lot in the news these days. And I mentioned how Saturday night, when I was in Minneapolis, I'd gone out to dinner at a restaurant that was an advertiser on the Minneapolis station there and had just an absolute marvelous meal, and they've seen an increase in sales. And how here in Portland, we've seen the same thing. And this is, I know that there is a group of people, there's a group of consultants who are running around saying, well, you know, progressive talk radio needs to become more mainstream. You got to stop being so liberal. You got to be more mainstream. You got to be more like Chris Matthews. You know, got to get them righties on and talk about sports from time to time and stuff like that. I don't buy it. And because we're seeing here in Portland, and it's not because Portland is an incredibly progressive town. There are five counties in this metro area that this radio station reaches, KPOJ, that I do a morning show on, and from which I'm broadcasting this national show. There are five counties. Three of those five counties voted for George Bush in both of the last two elections. This is a purple area. I mean, it's becoming increasingly blue, but the Republicans, up until this last election, controlled the state house for the last 16 years. And so I want to share an ad with you, not by way of saying this is an ad, because this is an ad for a local guy here in Portland, right? You know, the folks listening in Seattle or in Pittsburgh or in Grand Rapids or in St. Louis or in Dallas, Texas or whatever, you know, you, You're not going to be able to take your car to Tom Dwyer and have it fixed. But this is just an example of the kind of advertising, the kind of fearless advertising that actually works on progressive talk radio. And if there's, you know, progressive program directors out there listening, or people who are active in trying to build progressive talk radio, you know, take a listen and consider what happens when you get folks like we've got, like Randy White here at KPOJ. We actually have four people dedicated to selling nothing but progressive talk radio. And they're progressives. And they go out and they find progressive business owners, and we end up with ads like this. This is an ad from a local auto dealer. Great guy, locally owned, great guy. But it speaks for itself.
Hi, this is Tom Dwyer of Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, 230-2300. Our country is dangerously close to losing the protection our Constitution provides. Without KPOJ, we would have even less access to critical knowledge and information needed to help us protect our country from the onslaught of fascism. While Tom Dwyer Automotive Services is interested in delivering peace of mind service for your vehicles, nothing matters at this critical time as much as promoting and supporting progressive programming like KPOJ. From all of us at Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, thank you for your trust and support, and thank you for helping me support KPOJ.
Now, that's one of his more outspoken ads. Here's one that's just a little more straight up.
Hi, I'm Tom Dwyer, owner of Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, and I support Tom Hartman. We offer a complete range of services for 1992 and newer vehicles. We also service hybrids. We perform Portland's most thorough pre-purchase inspection. We offer DEQ failure repair and check engine light diagnosis. KPOJ services your intellect. We'll service your car. Call Tom Dwyer Automotive, 503-230-2300. Together, we can support democracy while adding years of life to your vehicle.
Now, Randy White, Randy hangs out in our studio. You're supposed to be out there selling, but progressive talk radio is so much fun.
I don't know. You're doing my job for me.
Okay. When Tom Dwyer started running these ads, what happened?
He had an onslaught of business of people that went in there and said, I am coming here to your automotive shop specifically because you're supporting progressive talk radio, thanking him and telling their friends, and he's seeing great business because of it, because he had the intestinal fortitude to say what the progressive audience wants to hear from businesses they want to give their money to.
Now, we had the same experience with a restaurant downtown.
Absolutely.
Blossoming Lotus.
Blossoming Lotus.
Yeah. And this is just all local stuff. This is what a local station can do, and this station is making money.
Well, I know that there's got to be other stations out there that have listeners that send emails to the program director saying, can I see a list of your advertisers? I need a plumber. Do you have a plumber that advertises on your progressive talk radio station? They look at their need and then try to find that product or service that matches their values.
Right. And so, you know, the wise thing is to do what very smart management did here at KPOJ, and that is to get progressives like you out there selling, looking for progressive businesses and selling progressive advertising on a progressive station. Gee, what a surprise, but it works.
You think?
Yeah. Randy, thanks a lot
for
hanging out here with us. Let's get back to the war in Iraq and the general insanity of George W. Bush. Tomorrow he's going to be announcing that he wants to do a troop surge. Really, it should be appropriately called an escalation. It is called an escalation. Ted Kennedy's called it an escalation. Even our Republican senator from Oregon, Gordon Smith, after the election, suddenly had a come-to-Jesus moment. Well, might have something to do with the fact that he's up for re-election in 2 years. He's speaking out now against the war in Iraq. So, anyhow, Barbara in Oakland, California. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I was wondering, since Congress has basically been colluding with Bush for the past 6 years, and since the Republicans in Congress are threatening the Democrats and trying to blame them for everything, are there any provisions in our laws to censure Congress for abrogating its responsibility or colluding with the executive and according him powers he's not entitled to? And if there is, I wonder if the Democrats could tell the Republicans that.
Yeah. To the best of my knowledge, there's not a censure power. There is an impeachment power. I mean, it is possible to impeach members of Congress. I'm not a constitutional expert, though. I don't know how that would happen. I think the main thing, Barbara, that we need to be doing is we need to let them hear from us. We need to be calling them. I've got a bunch of toll-free numbers here, 877-762-8762. 888-355-3588. Actually, I'll just stick with one, you know, for now. 888-355-3588. That gets you the switchboard of Congress, and you can ask for your member of Congress and give them hell. Tell them, you know, this is what I believe in. This is what I'm concerned about. Do it very politely. But I'm telling you, as Bernie has pointed out on this program many times, you call and you talk to a congressional staffer, and they are going to talk to the senator or the member of the House of Representatives, and the word is going to get passed along, even if they disagree. It's important that we speak out. How's that for a start?
I think it sounds great. I write to them a lot.
Okay, good. Good.
Thanks a lot.
Barbara, thank
Bye-bye.
You very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hey, Tim. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Dennis Kucinich one of the few senators who voted against going into Iraq?
Well, first of all, he's not a senator. He's a member of the House of Representatives. And the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives, the majority voted against going into Iraq. In the Senate, it was a minority, but in the House of Representatives, it was a majority of Democrats who voted against going into Iraq. And yes, Dennis Kucinich was one of them.
Okay,
and one of the more eloquent ones in his floor speech.
Sort of an introduction to what I really wanted to talk about. I think Congressman Kucinich is, as far as I know, the only progressive running for president in 2008. The mainstream media will probably ignore him, as they did before.
Yeah.
Does that mean that progressive radio has an obligation to try to get him on the air as much as they can?
Well, Dennis is on this program, you know, from time to time. Last time was maybe, I don't know, 6-8 months ago. He was actually here in Portland. He was in the studio. We gave a speech together. Dennis is a great guy. And, well, actually, the last time he was on was just a month or so ago when he declared his candidacy. We had him on. But I'm wondering, Julian, if John Edwards has become a progressive. I think that he's undergoing a transformation. We'll see. I mean, you know, ultimately we'll see what happens. And some people go, oh, you know, that's cynical, you know, kind of, a politician changing their perspective. But, hey, if the country is changing, if the people are demanding a certain set of positions, I think that's a fine thing. So, you know, whether it's Dennis Kucinich or John Edwards, again, I keep going back to the point that I've made many, many times, which is ultimately it's not even about who gets elected. I mean, that's a nice thing. That's the icing on the cake. Ultimately, it's about us getting involved in the political process, because if we are sufficiently involved, the people that we elect are going to have to do what we demand they do. Julian, thank you for your call. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey,
Good
Karen,
morning,
welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you so much. And I thank you for covering that Wall Street Journal article. I'm in the 9th Congressional District of Washington State, and I was reading in this New York Times article this morning, and it looks like my Congressman, Adam Smith, may be wobbling on the surge, and I'm really concerned.
Your Congressman is a Democrat?
Yes, he is.
And he might be saying, yes, let's do a surge?
Well, what he's saying is that he feared that withholding financing, even for new troops being sent to Iraq, would have a detrimental effect on all forces.
Yeah, so he doesn't want to go along with the escalation of the... Well, we'll see. I mean, these guys, particularly in districts which are...
It is a military district, by the way.
Yeah, see, that's the problem. I mean, I have, for example, Congressman Brian Baird of Washington State. He's on my local show every week. I talked with him yesterday morning. There's a whole bunch of things that I disagree with Brian Baird about, you know, positions that we have that are different. But the fact of the matter is that he represents his district. He represents the point of view of the majority of the people in his district in those areas where he and I disagree. And I have to respect that. I have to say, you know, Brian, you and I are going to disagree, but you're representing your district. You're not representing Tom Hartman, the talk show host. And so, you know, I think that's a reasonable thing. We just have to get more people involved in this. 45 minutes past the hour. Place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. I'll tell you, these guys are rolling over in their graves right now. The danger is that if the Jordanians, this from today's Wall Street Journal, this nightmare scenario article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, this is a quote from, well, let's see here. Hang on just a second. This is, he says, and there's a high-level Arab official. Yeah, a Jordanian official. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a U.S. military planner who recently met with leaders in the region, an unidentified U.S. military planner. He says, the danger is that if the Jordanians carve out a security zone or buffer zone inside Iraq, that the Syrians, Saudis, and Turks will all follow. The Syrians could move into western Nineveh province, while the Turks could send troops to protect the Sunni Turkmen population in the north, he says. The Jordanians are flipped out about this. They're concerned that the Sunnis are fleeing Shiite oppression, and this could turn Amman into the center of Sunni resistance against the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. Already, the Jordanian capital is home to about 900,000 Iraqis, 15% of the population. As King Abdullah, this has got to be a terrible problem for him. The Jordanians worry that, this is the Wall Street Journal again, the Jordanians worry that Iraq's Shiite militias could send small teams of militants to Amman to launch assassination campaigns or terrorist attacks against the Sunni insurgency. We have quite enough instability in Jordan as it is, said one senior Jordanian official. And here's where it gets truly weird. Weird is not even a strong enough word. A huge challenge, this is from the Wall Street Journal, a huge challenge for the U.S. is that many of its Sunni allies in the region already view the current situation in Iraq as a defeat for their cause and a near-complete victory for Iran. In recent weeks, now get this, listen to this carefully, this is not the Nation magazine, this is the Wall Street Journal, not to put down the Nation magazine, but I mean this is the conservative press in America. This is the business press in America. When they're talking like this, you know it's probably five orders of magnitude worse than that. This is, in recent weeks, some of the U.S. allies in the Gulf have quietly advocated breaking up the Iraqi government in favor of a military dictatorship. Governed by a secular Shiite, a Sunni, and a Kurd, according to the military planner. The military dictatorship would rule until the country could be stabilized and new elections held. Religious parties would be banned from participating in future elections. What is it the Iraqis say, you know, about the new government? Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Randall in Seattle. Hey, Randall, welcome to the program.
Oh, geez, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Just wanted to say I appreciate your program a lot. I've listened for a long time, and I really like the attitude as much as the ideas.
Thank you.
But I had actually called to talk about something that was on yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That's all right.
Sure.
Someone mentioned Joe Biden had said that Congress can't micromanage the war. And I didn't get to hear the rest of the conversation, but I had read Mitch McConnell actually said that over the weekend, the Republican from Kentucky. So I don't really know
yeah.
if it was Biden, but...
Well, you know, at a certain level, Congress can't. They're not the commander-in-chief of the military, but at a larger level, they certainly can, and they have. In 1970, for example, they passed a law called the Foreign Supplemental Assistance Law. This is during Vietnam. And quoting from the law, quote, prohibits the use of funds for the introduction of U.S. troops to Cambodia or to provide military advisors to Cambodian forces, end quote. In 1982, during the Reagan administration, Congress passed the Defense Appropriation Act, and it, quote, prohibited covert military assistance for Nicaragua, end quote. Reagan, by the way, you know, ignored that law, broke the law, and was never held to account for it. In 1994, Congress restricted the use of funds for, quote, for United States military participation in to continue Operation Restore Hope in and around Rwanda after October 7, 1994. These are all laws.
Right.
This is,
well,
and you know, this is, if that's not micromanaging, I don't know what is.
Well, it's like that choice of words you mentioned earlier between surge and escalation.
Yeah.
You can call it micromanaging, or you can call it assuming their constitutional responsibility. You know.
Yeah. Indeed.
Basically, they have the responsibility and the right to declare war and to fund it. So,
And in fact, the Constitution says that every 2 years they have to renew it if they want to, if there is going to be funding for a war. And the reason for that is because the founders and framers, the framers of the Constitution, got it that, you know, to paraphrase James Madison, no democratic republic can survive in the face of continual warfare. Can't happen.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you just can't have a democracy. I mean, he was very eloquent about it and waxed at length about it on numerous occasions, how important it was that we not ever find ourselves in a state of perpetual war. Thanks a lot for the call, Randall. Sean in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, we just have a few seconds left, Sean, before we have to wrap the hour. What's up?
Hey, my quick question was, I've been hearing about a war in Iran that's impending more than it has been in the last few years. I'm curious about how that might impact a military draft.
Well, the Selective Service is being reactivated. Pardon?
The likelihood of either.
I think the likelihood of a war in Iran is, had a Democratic Congress not been elected, I would have said 100%. Now I think it's probably 60%. And the probability of a draft, that's a tough one. That's a real tough one. I think it's extremely unlikely because the draft is the thing that's going to cause us to end the war. The Republicans can't sustain a draft. I'm, you know, personally in favor of a national service program, which would include military service, but also civilian options. But that's a whole other riff. Anyhow, we'll be back with the leader, the national spokesman for the Revolutionary Communist Party. You want to hear a real lefty? Right after the news. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Senator William Fulbright. The age of warrior kings and of warrior presidents has passed. The nuclear age calls for a different kind of leadership, a leadership of intellect, judgment, tolerance, rationality, a leadership committed to human values, to world peace, to the improvement of the human condition. The attributes upon which we must draw are the human attributes of compassion and common sense, of intellect and creative imagination, and of empathy and understanding between cultures. The late Senator J. William Fulbright. Carl Dix is with us. We often folks say, this is the left, or he's the left, or this is the, oh, we got a lefty, we got a left, what's the left point of view? It's especially on, like Carl, or on like Chris Matthews or whatnot, they'll get some moderate Democrat on and go, well, you lefties. I thought we'd talk to a real lefty here. Carl Dix is the national spokesperson for the Revolutionary Communist Party, their website, revcom.us. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. First of
Glad
all,
to be on.
You are out there organizing a mass protest with regard to Sean Bell and police brutality in New York.
Yes, I've been involved in the protest around the Sean Bell case. I mean, the thing about what happened with Sean Bell is that it's all too typical of what happens in this society. People, especially young people, black and Latino people, shot down by the police, unarmed, not involved in doing anything wrong at the time. And what happens is that gets justified, covered over, the cops never get punished for it. And it's one of the many things that's wrong with this setup. And at the heart of the problems with this setup, in our view as revolutionary communists, is the capitalist system and the way in which it works.
How does a capitalist system cause racist cops to misbehave?
Well, but here's the problem.
I mean, it seems to me like I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. I was in East Germany when it was East Germany, you know, a couple of communist countries. And the cops there weren't any nicer than any cops I've met here.
Yeah, well,
In fact, I got shook down. I was on the road into Kaliningrad, and we got stopped by a police roadblock, or not a roadblock, but, you know, they flagged us down. And it was because we were obviously not locals, and they wouldn't let us go until we paid them a bribe. I had to give these guys a half a box of chocolate bars and some money before they'd let us go. I mean, you know, aren't we talking about human nature here, not institutional systems?
No, we're not talking about human nature. We're talking about how people are under exploiting societies. You were in the Soviet Union when it was a state capitalist society, which it's been for decades, and it had the problems there are very similar to the problems here. And the reason I say this is capitalism is that the police are out there enforcing the dominant economic and social relations of American capitalism and white supremacy. That's why this brutality and violence is mostly directed in Black and Latino communities. It's not a question of the individual cops and their proclivities, because if that was the problem, the authorities would punish those cops who did this because they would consider it wrong things that they were doing. That punishment happens.
Right, the authorities are as much a part of the system as the cops are. But the question then is, if you say, okay, the means of production and distribution, one definition of capitalism is that the means of production and distribution are privately owned, and one definition of communism is that the means of production and distribution are publicly owned, are owned by the state, that, you know, factories and wholesalers and retailers. And I don't get how having the means of production and distribution be owned collectively as instead of privately is going to in any way diminish institutional racism.
Oh, but here's where the difference has to be, that collective ownership has to be real through the instrument of having political power in the hands of the people, not just in name, but increasingly having more and more people involved in more and more administration of every sphere of society. And it's through that you have people actually asserting their interest in society, as opposed to being dictated to, whether that dictation comes down in the state capitalist Soviet Union through the party bosses or in the U.S. through the interest of the capitalist imperialist.
But you're talking about the political end of it. I mean, what you're really describing is democracy.
End reacts back on the economic end.
Yeah, but
because
for example,
if you're in a situation like the state capitalist Soviet Union where in name, things were collectively owned, but things were dictated to people by the.
It was essentially an oligarchy.
The Soviet Union, who were themselves the capitalist, state capitalist in that society, they were actually. Serving interest in the society and not the interest of the masses of people. The same thing happens here. I mean, you see something like. People vote in a way to indicate that they want the Iraq war ended and what plans come and things are going to go. Well, there's going to be a surge in troops. A surge does not sound like withdrawal, ending the troops, stopping an immoral, illegitimate, and illegal war.
Well, I don't disagree with you that there's a problem.
That's not what's in the interest of the imperialists.
But Carl, I've been, for example, on a kibbutz. I didn't live in it or work in it, but I visited a kibbutz in Israel, which is a purely communist system. I've lived in a community and I've participated with and actually wrote a chapter in my book Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight about a communist a commune in Vermont that was run as communist, and you know where everybody collectively owned everything. And when you have 100 people doing it. It seems to work quite well. I mean, it's the way that humans have organized society for pretty much forever. It's the way that Aboriginal and Indigenous societies work. But I have never seen or heard of a society with more than a couple thousand people where this could work. Because once society gets large enough that people can be anonymous, the exploiters start rising up.
Well, the question is, you have to transform society to the point and actually struggle to keep the exploiters from rising up.
And you're talking about changing
societies, communist societies have in fact worked.
Name one.
China under Mao, they accomplished miraculous things.
They killed 30 million people.
They doubled the life expectancy to 65 years in less than a generation. They cut infant mortality from horrendous rates.
They did that with public health. They did that with public health things. This had nothing to do with the form of government. We did the same thing here when we started chlorinating water.
It actually had everything to do with the form of government because The Chinese did it in a country that had been dominated and exploited by imperialism, where they used to kill girl babies because it was a hindrance to have a girl child.
They still do.
But that stopped during the revolution. It has come back because China is no longer a place where the means of production are collectively owned and moved forward by the people. In fact, China is trying to become a rival of the U.S. on an imperialist tip, and that's what's brought these social ills back, including things like drug use and prostitution, which has...
Carl, I can tell you, I was in China. I spent the whole month of November 1986 in Beijing, and that was before the reindustrialization of China. That was when you could stand out in front of Tiananmen Square on an eight-lane street and see one car every 20 minutes.
Did you say 1986?
1986, yeah.
Yeah, that was 10 years after Deng Xiaoping and company had taken over and back on a capitalist path.
But there was very little evidence of it that I could see. I mean, it was a sleepy backwater.
The evidence of it would have been there in terms of the changing relations among people. Girl infanticide had begun to come back in the 70s and 80s. Prostitution and drug use had begun to come back, and they were there. They may not have been widely seen and known, but they had been brought back. And see, the key to all of this is that you got to make a revolution. You got to take power from the hands of these imperialists to dominate society.
And then what do you do?
And it's got to really be there.
And then what do you do? How would you replace the United States government? We have about a half a minute, 45 seconds here, Carl. I'm sorry.
Well, Bob Avakian has worked at this, and he's brought forward a synthesis on it. And the key part to that is that you have to increasingly involve more and more people in the administering of every sphere of society. You have to encourage an atmosphere
where
people
are encouraged. But you got a lot of people who don't have time.
Let me bring this forward. Where people are encouraged to bring their questions, their disagreements, their confusion up. And that's all wrangled and debated over as part of getting to the truth, because you have to base yourself on what reality actually is in order to transform it. That would be the key part of it. You also have to socialize the means of production, as you talked about. But if you did that without really putting power in the hands of the people, you're not actually transforming things. And I don't think the problem is one of human nature. I think it's a problem of people being put in conditions where they're forced to go at each other. And if we can create conditions where people can work together in common for the common good, then we can transform the way people look at stuff.
Okay. Carl Dix, the Revolutionary Communist Party, their website, revcom, revcom.us. Carl, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you, and you know, keep up the protest there on Sean Bell. 16 minutes past the hour.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. Well, this, you know, as I said, you know, I talked to Andrea Mitchell this morning on my local show. She has a new book out, and my question was, why is it that when you get somebody on who says, you know, we need a national health care program, like 36 of the other 37 industrialized nations in the world have, or we need to have slightly higher taxes on carbon in order to maintain an environment that isn't going to kill us, or that you know, private corporations should not be telling us how we voted, you know, just fundamental stuff, that if you do the polls, the vast majority of Americans are in favor of this, and yet when folks come on, politicians who come on programs, on mainstream media programs, who take these positions, they're called, you lefties. They're branded as leftists, as liberals, as far left. And her answer was, well, I don't think we should be using these labels, but, you know, which was kind of a nice way of dodging the question. But the bottom line is that, you know, that's what's constantly being said. And I'm saying, no, I'm sorry. The real left is the Communist Party, and the Communist Party is, as you just heard, is calling for a revolution and for we the people, presumably for the state, to own everything. And I don't go along with it. I don't buy it. I'm sorry. I'm not a communist. I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for a business model where businesses increasingly are owned by their employees. And there are some great examples of that in the United States. But that's a whole different thing. The minute that you give government the power to drive that from the top down, I think that you know, you've just gone down a really dangerous road. Now, the one exception to that is semi-socialism, democratic socialism, for example. If you look at, you know, various countries around the world, what you find is that in many countries, you have the natural monopolies, the state monopolies, are owned by the people. And Chavez is talking about doing this. This also from today's Wall Street Journal. He's talking about 21st century socialism. What's he going to do? He's going to take the country's biggest telecommunications electricity firms, which by coincidence are both owned by American companies in Venezuela, and nationalize them. Now, this, of course, has the American companies rather concerned. It has the Wall Street Journal rather concerned. In this article by David Lujau, Jose de Corba, and Raul Galejos in Caracas, although he would reveal no details, Mr. Chavez said he would nationalize the country's largest publicly traded private company, Compañía Nacional del Telefonos de Venezuela, known as CANTV. The company, privatized in 1991, is controlled by the U.S. telecom giant Verizon. He also vowed to nationalize Electricidad de Caracas, controlled by Arlington-based AES Group. Now, this is the one area where I think you can make a really strong case at a local level, not necessarily a national level, for local control. With regard to telecommunications, the big one is power. Because we're talking about, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The majority of power companies in the United States are owned by the people. They're publicly owned utilities, the majority of them. And I think, frankly, that that's a good thing. And we find the same thing is happening, you know, all over the world, that in the Scandinavian countries, for example, the majority of the power companies are owned by the people. They're publicly owned companies rather than privately owned companies. They do a good job of delivering good prices and very good service. Whereas when you privatize, let's deregulate this stuff. Let's privatize it, like Enron. You know, wasn't that a marvelous experiment? Let's just give Enron control of all of the power and let them do whatever they want. It essentially destroyed California. I mean, it was a slick trick. You had Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was just an actor, meeting in secret and in private with Ken Lay. And we still don't know to this day exactly what it was all about, but it seems that what might have come out of it was suddenly the prices for electricity were going through the roof in California, and we know that it was being manipulated. It was being manipulated out of the town where I live in Portland, where the trading was going on, and all those guys, let's stick it to Granny, ha, 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 you know, and you've heard the clips. And I think that there's a very strong case to be made for publicly owned power, because there's only one wire coming into my house. It's a natural monopoly. And where you have natural monopolies, there's a strong argument for the people collectively owning them on a local basis. On a local basis. And where you have monopolies that aren't quite that tight, strong regulation. Telecommunications, for example. Yeah, I'm in favor of that. But I don't want the government making my shoes. Don't want the government making my car. I just don't think it works. So now you've heard the whole thing, the whole spectrum. Yes. What's gonna happen with Iraq? What's gonna happen with the US Congress? We're gonna come back with a quick look at Iraq, and we'll continue with the news of the day. 27 and your calls, of course. 27 minutes past the hour, it's Tom Hartman.
But ain't that America? You and me. Ain't that America? Something to see, baby. Ain't that America? Home of the free, yeah. Little Frank Houses for you and me.
And welcome back, Talk Radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a quick heads up. This Friday night I'll be at 8:30 at the Nevada Theater. in Nevada City, California, for the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. I'll be giving a brief talk along with a screening of Crude Impact, a powerful and timely movie that explores the interconnection between human domination of the planet and the discovery and use of oil. Features me, Tom Hartman, and my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Then January 25th, 26th, I'll be in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel that night, the 25th. I'll be giving a talk on Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, what we can do about it. It's open to the public. So if you're interested in coming down Thursday night, January 25th, I'll be at the Mayflower Hotel there. And in March 1st and 2nd, and I'll be back in Washington, D.C. again, the American Conservative Union Foundation sponsoring a radio row, and we'll be broadcasting our show live from there. So it should be very interesting. By the way, check out my new review of Food of the Gods by Terrence McKenna at BuzzFlash.com. Discover why the first line of the review says, I took some drugs today to help me write this review. The bottom line on this, simplify all this, is what we really want in a democracy is we the people owning the commons, those things that it's appropriate for us to collectively own because they have to do with our collective security, our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And allowing, on the other hand, allowing capitalism, regulated capitalism, allowing business operating within reasonable rules. Rules that protect we the people from predators, but allowing that to exist. That's my take on all this. And that's what I think Hugo Chavez is doing down in Venezuela, at least as far as I can tell. We'll see, you know, where he goes with all of this. And that is, you know, certainly what has happened in, for example, the Scandinavian countries. If you look, or the European countries, for example. Austria has a public power system. Denmark has a publicly owned power system. Finland has a publicly owned power system. France has a publicly owned power system. Ireland, Greece, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Northern Ireland, they're all publicly owned. These are not, you know, screaming communist countries or even socialist countries or even social democracies, by and large. These, you know, they're whatever you would call their democracies. Only in England and Wales, Germany and Belgium, have they experimented with privatizing their power systems. And the experiment in England, by the way, has been, to a large extent, a disaster. You know, look at what happened. And beyond that, I mean, look at what happened when they privatized the rail system in England. Boy, that was a huge disaster, an ongoing train wreck. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466, TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Gene in Napa, California on the line, listening on the Quake. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. I was talking to a Vietnam vet over the weekend, and he was telling me that they destroyed villages in Vietnam, whole villages, and they called it pacification at the time.
Yes. And we did the same thing. We did something very similar to that in Fallujah.
Well, this is what the comparison I was going to make. It sounds like that's what they want to do in the perimeter of Baghdad.
Well, if they want to, they're going to need a heck of a lot more than 20,000 people. Baghdad is a city the size of Manhattan. I mean, you've got 5 million people living there. This is a major city with a lot of people in it, and 20,000 soldiers, dressed up like soldiers, which is like have a bullseye on your back, isn't going to do it.
And I just, when the Pentagon comes up with these terms like pacification and surge, you know, they're just such euphemisms for the same sort of aggressive, really unsuccessful behavior in these guerrilla wars that it's almost like a psyops trick to me on the public to use these words. It's like selling product or something. It's marketing. It's just horrible.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you at all, Gene. It very much is, you know, the focus group language and the whole thing. Thank you for the call.
What was the name of that oil documentary again that you were going to be talking about?
Oh, it's called Crude Impact.
Crude Impact.
Yeah, it's a movie that's going to be playing at the Wet n' Wild Film Festival in Nevada. is it pronounced?
Nevada City.
Nevada City, California.
You know, Tom, I remember the old days, KQED or the public broadcasting television. Mm. They used to run some of these documentaries.
Oh, I know. It's now I call it National Republican Radio.
Yes, and now the television doesn't even pick up these wonderful documentaries.
Yeah, you're right. Gene,
so I'll be watching for it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. And oddly enough, I mean, you know, sometimes it's like you've stepped into the Twilight Zone, right? This Ollie North, of all people. Well, you know, I guess when you've been in the military, you have some sense of what's real. And you know, Ollie North talking with Bill O'Reilly. And O'Reilly puts forward the Republican talking point, as is his job, right?
All right, so basically what the military people tell me is that this is a play to bolster the confidence of the Iraqi forces in Baghdad, to give them more American counterparts, people with them, to try to accelerate their training so they can provide security for the capital city. That's what the thinking is. Do you agree with the thinking, and will it work?
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Bill, we've got your Republican talking point. As I've been saying all along, though, this is not about a military strategy. These guys are going to do the Marshall Plan, and they're going to do it, you know, in quiet, in the background. And that will probably have some positive effect. But, you know, throwing more military in, disaster. And Ollie North replies to Bill O'Reilly's question.
No, I don't, Bill. And that one of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, guardsmen, or Marines that I interviewed in my eighth trip back there told me they wanted more U.S. boots on the ground. In fact, nearly all expressed just the opposite. We don't need more American troops. We need more Iraqi troops, was a common refrain. And my concern is that incrementally U.S. troop strength out there, as first suggested last summer during the congressional campaign, sounds eerily like Lyndon Johnson's plan to save Vietnam back in the 60s by gradual escalation as a way not to lose, and of course then avoid the necessity of directly confronting North Vietnam.
All right.
Amazing. So you got Ollie North saying it's just like Vietnam. I mean, you know, how weird does it get, right? How weird does it get? Let's take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights on the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannons. And there is blood.
The following are security developments in Iraq as of 1,000 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday. This is from Reuters. Deadline Baghdad. U.S. and Iraqi forces clashed with gunmen in central Baghdad, coming under fire from mortars and rocket-propelled grenades during raids near Haifa Street, the U.S. military said, adding three insurgents were arrested. Iraqi defense officials said 11 were arrested, including seven Syrians. Near Balad Ruz, U.S. and Iraqi forces conducted a ground and air assault operation and killed several insurgents, according to the U.S. military. In Yusufia, Iraqi troops arrested Ibrahim al-Jabouri, known as the Prince of Al-Qaeda al-Yusufia, and Abdullah al-Zabui, leader of the 20th Revolutionary Brigade's insurgents group in that town. And in Baghdad, the Iraqi army released eight people who had been kidnapped by insurgents in Omar Street in central Baghdad, according to ministry sources. So, what's going on in Iraq? There is just a broad overview of kind of the news of the day here, just very quickly, with thanks and compliments to the folks at the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. Gordon Smith, I mentioned, Gordon Smith is the Republican senator from Oregon, and for the last 4 years he's been voting 90% of the time with George W. Bush. The guy is a hardcore right-winger, and he's up for re-election in 2 years, and he saw which way the wind was blowing in the elections. The Democrats just took the Oregon House. Democrats just took the U.S. House. Democrats just took the U.S. Senate. And here he is, a Republican senator, an increasingly endangered species. And so he's part of a group with 30 Republican senators meeting with the president yesterday, and he comes out and he says, and I quote, "It was clear to me that a decision has been made for a surge of at least 20,000 additional troops." And then the senator from Mississippi, Thad Cochran, He says, I think I was the only senator who acted like he would be supportive. Amazing. George Tenet is apparently writing a new book. Talk about some tales to tell. Somebody ought to tell George Tenet about Bill Casey. Bill Casey was the campaign manager for George Bush Sr. in the 1980 Reagan-Bush election. And he, you know, successfully helped beat Jimmy Carter. And the main way that they beat Jimmy Carter was by, apparently, you know, this is what's alleged. There's several books about this. Barbara Honegger's October Surprise, Gary Sick's October Surprise, numerous articles out there. By Bill Casey and perhaps George Bush Sr., but in all probability, Bill Casey and a few other folks going over to Paris and negotiating with the Ayatollahs to hang on to the U.S. hostages that the, quote, students, unquote, had taken until after the election. If they could do that, Jimmy Carter, who was ahead in the polls at the time that the hostages were taken by as much as 10 points, everybody considered Ronald Reagan to be a right-wing crackpot. Even George Bush Sr. regarded Ronald Reagan as a right-wing crackpot, referred to his economic policies as voodoo economics. So anyhow, George Bush Sr., you know, former head of the CIA, RNC, all that stuff, he sends Bill Casey over there. They cut this deal. And the day that Bill Casey is supposed to testify before Congress and spill his guts on this, he's head of the CIA now. He has a seizure. They take him off to the hospital and cut out the part of his brain responsible for speech. So now we've got another CIA director who's says he's gonna tell all. Somebody ought to warn George Tenet about what happened to Bill Casey. 46 minutes past the hour.
This is a rich man's country. Papa said it for sure. This is a rich man's country. Ain't no place to be poor. Rich man owns a big car and drives himself all around. More than hitches a ride.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 51 minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner's on the line with us from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you. Today, Senator Kennedy is actually giving a speech at the press club as we speak on the bill that he's introducing. He essentially said that historically the Congress has the power of the purse, and what he's saying is before the president sends additional American troops into a civil war, the president has to come back to Congress and get that authority for the deployment. And he's basically saying members of Congress should also be held accountable.
Now, you know, Kennedy is quite outspoken on this, and yet yesterday or the day before, Joe Biden was saying, well, you know, I don't think the Congress can micromanage the war. There seems to be a difference of opinion in the Senate.
Well, there's definitely a difference of opinion in the Senate, and in fact, actually, Carl Levin today, the senator from Michigan, who's the head chairman of the Armed Service Committee, he said that he's going to present his new plan, and he basically said that he believes that Congress must agree and come to a bipartisan consensus, because he said that otherwise it's just not going to happen because, you know, the president will just veto anything. And he's also saying that Congress is not going to cut off funding for the troops, but he said that they could place a cap on the troops or pass some kind of resolution which would actually require the president to get congressional approval for any increase. And
isn't that essentially what Kennedy is saying?
Well, Kennedy wants to, yes, but Kennedy it wants to cut off funding immediately, and essentially Levin, or at least that's what I understand, don't hold me to it, Levin wants to say that any increase be tied to a phased reduction of the troops within 4 to 6 months.
Now, how is this playing out in the House of Representatives?
Well, it's interesting. Boehner, who's now the House Minority Leader, said that Democrats and Republicans have to work together, but he wants a plan from the President accompanied by specifics. He's believing that that is going to happen, and so that's the Republican. I think that the House Dems are somewhat in line with, most of them are, with more or less of a combination between, you know, a Kennedy and 11 approach. Now, the White House is also saying, look, we've met with already 30 senators individually in groups. We're going to even meet with more senators next week. The president's going to be going to Fort Benning, Georgia, to meet with the troops after his speech. So they also say that the State Department, via Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates from the Defense Secretary, are going to testify on the war in planned hearings on the Hill, probably beginning next week.
We have a caller, Vera in San Leandro, California. To this issue, Vera, you wanted to speak.
Hi, Tom. It's just a great pleasure to talk to you. I feel that the reason, at least two possible reasons why Nancy Pelosi, as well as other Democrats, and including Republicans, that if they are, you know, are wishy-washy about still being on Bush's side, it could possibly two reasons. They themselves are profiting from this war. And also it could be that they, since Bush is, has such a stranglehold, they have such a, control of the corporations and vice versa, that they themselves, these congressmen, don't want to lose the funding from the corporations.
Mm-hmm. Good point and good question, Vera. Thank you for calling. What's your take on that, Ellen Ratner? That, I mean, this is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, is it not?
Very much so, and I think that we are certainly, you know, seeing that happen. It will be interesting to see what happens when the good senator from Vermont, Mr. Leahy, works on war profiteering, because that is his big issue in this Congress.
Yeah, isn't there a committee that was the McCarthy Committee and that actually started out as the Truman Committee? That's what Pat Leahy is head of now, right?
I believe you're right, and don't
it's like the Permanent
me.
Committee on
right.
Investigations or something like that.
Right.
And it's actually, you know, it was, some would say, misused by Joe McCarthy, but basically it was set up by Harry Truman to look into war profiteering when he was a senator.
Yes, it was essentially an oversight committee.
Right, during World War II. And if they start going after some of these big corporations and saying, hey, wait a minute, you guys, Jim Hightower reported the other day that the CEOs of the largest defense contractors have taken in pay and compensation since this war started over $1 trillion. It's a mind-boggling amount of money.
It is mind-boggling.
I mean, we're talking, it's not a billion. It's a trillion. It's incredible. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Good talking with you today. 56 minutes past the hour. I'll be back after the news at the top of the hour with Chris Hedges. Is the Christian right, or it's not even the Christian right, is a fringe element, a rogue fringe element within Christianity, actually trying to take over the military of the United States? We'll get into that right after this.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America, and arguably of the world. Chris Hedges is on the line with us. He's the author of a new book, American Fascists. There's that word. The Christian Right and the War on America. Chris Hedges, welcome.
Thank you.
This last weekend I was traveling a lot. I was in Pittsburgh and Minneapolis and whatnot, and on my trip I took your book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, and read most of it. And I have to say it's a remarkable book, and it gave me a tremendous insight into you. You're a brilliant writer, and we've shared a lot of experiences, without getting into the whole thing. But I find it interesting that two Christians who have both experienced anyway seminary and both been through an arc, shall we say, of in and out and through Christianity, and are discussing the what may be the destruction of Christianity in the United States. Do you think speaking too strongly in that context?
Well, certainly, the gross misuse of Christianity. I don't look at these people as Christians. I look at this as a mass movement. They've successfully hijacked Christian language and Christian iconography, as well as the iconography of American patriotism, to push forward a movement that at its core is about the destruction of our open society. I mean, from a religious point of view, I think they're heretics.
I agree with you. In fact, I would almost argue that instead of being called the Christian right, they should be called the Christian fringe, or a fringe, element of Christianity, or something like that. But tell us, in American Fascists, you start out with a great quote from Umberto Eco, basically defining fascism, and then through the course of the book, a whole series of reporting, you define the terms from the conversion, the cult of masculinity, the war on truth, the techniques that are used by this new Reich to redefine in their minds Christianity and then proselytize and then use that to seek the levers of power in the United States.
Well, I think, when you go back and read people like Hannah Arendt or Karl Popper or even Robert Paxton's book, The Anatomy of Fascism, you find that generically fascist movements always propel themselves forward by adopting the most sort of comforting symbols and language of the societies that they're in. And you can just see that in a small way in the difference, the pretty major differences between Italian and German fascism. Any of these movements, when they rise up, a fascist movement in the United States is not going to come back with swastikas and brown shirts. It's going to come back, as Robert Paxton said, with people, mass recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance and stars and bars.
Right, or as Sinclair Lewis talked about.
Sinclair Lewis, exactly, in the book It Can't Happen Here. And I think that this is a period, a historical period. If there's an analogy to be drawn to a previous period, it would be similar to the 1930s in the United States, when there was a huge groundswell of support, especially by American industrialists, a great deal of praise and sympathy lavished, particularly on Mussolini's corporatism, this movement to defang labor unions and empower industrialists at the expense of the workers. Your Father Conlin, there was, Charles Lindbergh, there was a serious flirtation on the part of the American right with European fascism.
Well, it even went a bit beyond that. If General Smedley Butler is to be believed, they were actually going to stage a coup against Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that the difference between the 1930s and now is that there were powerful progressive forces in American society, labor unions, an unfettered free press, that were able to blunt this movement that culminated with the New Deal. And certainly the heart of my book is that the engine of this movement is despair. We have disenfranchised tens of millions of Americans, with the flight of manufacturing jobs. There are parts of this country that look like the developing world. And you cannot distort a society to this extent and not have grave political consequences. And this isn't a particularly new thought. Plutarch wrote about this in ancient Athens, talking about how an imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. And I think that until we address this dislocation, this disenfranchisement of tens of millions of Americans from our own society, and re-enfranchise them, we're not going to be able to blunt this movement, which is essentially a movement that has removed people from a reality-based belief system, born, you know, out of an experience of their own despair into this world of magic, this sort of mythical world where, you know, miracles happen and God has a plan for your, you know, divine plan for you, et cetera.
In your last chapter, you describe Tim LaHaye and you know, his whole, his background as a huckster and the whole mythology that is well, actually not just in the last chapter, but driving this thing. In the middle of the book, there's a part where you talk about the experience of the National Religious Broadcasters Association convention. Back in 1978, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for abused kids and severely emotionally disturbed kids, and I went to the NAB conference in, it might have been 79, thinking that I may find among the Christians there some sources of funding, some ideas, you know, where can I write some grants or something. It was ultimately an unsuccessful trip in that context. But what was fascinating to me was that Robert Shiller, the guy, you know, Mr. Crystal Cathedral,
right,
gave the opening keynote speech. Now, this was before the meltdown of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and everybody else, and these guys were all riding high. And Robert Shiller got up in front of about 3,000 people, and I was there in the audience. I was toward the back, and I could see the room. And he preached a hell and brimstone sermon, which the likes of which I'd never heard out of him. He's always, you know, Mr. Smile, Mr. Nice Guy. He was preaching from Jeremiah about, you know, I gave you my sheep, and you have ravaged them. You know, where God is talking to his ministers, basically, and saying, you failed to care for my flock. And Shiller was just absolutely giving hell to these televangelists. And in the very end, he got this very tepid, I would say a third of the room didn't even applaud. And, I mean, he was treated like a pariah. He walked off stage alone. I thought it was one of the most brilliant talks that I, you know, sermons that I had ever heard, you know, these guys talking to. And ultimately, he was proved right. But there was this, nonetheless, there was a sense at that time that there could be dialogue within mainstream Christianity about the nature of mainstream Christianity. Reading the chapter in your book about your far more recent visit, mine was more than 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago, I get the sense that even that diversity is gone.
Well, I think, you know, you actually touch there on a really important point, that these are not traditional evangelicals. We're no longer dealing with Billy Graham. We're dealing with a wholly different animal. You know, they're not traditional fundamentalists who, of course, call on people to remove themselves from the contaminants of politics and secular society. They're not traditional evangelicals who are open to various ways to come to Christ and really run across the political spectrum. The people who hold the levels of power in this movement are most properly called dominionists or Christian reconstructionists, who have built this movement around the acquisition of power, of political power, to create the Christian state. And that is something that's very new. It's something that, of course, Billy Graham spent a lot of time, after being burned by Richard Nixon, warning evangelicals against. And I think that they...
And it's what Shiller was warning against,
and
by the way.
What Shiller, who comes out of the Power of Positive Thinking and
right.
Norman Vincent Peale. And, this,
right.
and in that sense, this is it's a completely different movement. And we're still using terms like evangelical or fundamentalists, because I think that we fail to grasp who these people are, who James Dobson is, who Jerry Falwell ultimately
and
is.
And at their core, they're fascists.
Yes, I think that if you dissect the belief system that they push forward, everything from the cult of masculinity to that final aesthetic being violence, to the, you know, the delegitimization of anybody outside the movement, the belief that they are, you know, that others are only to be tolerated if they convert or to be eradicated. Yes, I think the word fascism is an appropriate word.
Chris, can you stick around for another 15 minutes?
Sure.
I would appreciate it. I'd like to go just a little deeper with this conversation, and something we Rarely do, but keeping guests over. But Chris Hedges, he's the author of American Fascist, The Christian Right and the War on America. And I would say the war on religion in this country, frankly. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Can you feel what's happening here? Everything is changing all around you. It's in the air, electricity.
And welcome back to the real free speech zone. No pass from the RNC required. We won't haul you off if there's a bumper sticker on your car that says no blood for oil. Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Chris Hedges. He's the author of a new book, American Fascist, The Christian Right and the War on America, and other previous books, including Losing Moses on the Freeway. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
I think we were just getting to the core issue of this book, which is that these people who refer to themselves as the Christian right in America and who are so respectfully treated by the mainstream media, the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertsons of the world, that they, in fact, if Jesus Christ were to return to Earth, I have a feeling he would turn his back on them in a second.
Well, these are the new version of the Pharisees. I mean, the notion that sort of Jesus Christ came to make us all rich itself is blasphemy. Yeah. To anyone who's read the Gospels. The fact that Christ would endorse imperial violence is just an anathema. I mean, I'm not a pacifist, but Jesus was clearly a pacifist. They talk about acculturating the country to Christianity. What they've done is taken the worst of American imperialism and capitalism and acculturated Christianity.
And in transforming Christianity, they're also trying to transform this country. You mentioned the Dominionist movement, and the attempt to replace the Constitution essentially with their interpretation of the Bible. This is like the mullahs in Iran.
Well, of course. I mean, that what we're doing is seeing our version of a fundamentalist movement rise to power, and all radical or fundamentalist ideologies or movements seek to destroy the middle ground within their own country first, and that's precisely what's happening here. I mean, they these movements always feed off of each other in the same way that, for instance, in the war in the Balkans, Croatian nationalists led by Franjo Tuđman fed off of Serbian nationalists led by Slobodan Milosevic.
Sure.
And what we're seeing is a hollowing out of the American center, a sort of defanging and delegitimization of the American moderate political center, and of course that's gone a long way under the Bush administration.
And the religious center. Oh, you must not be a real Christian if you don't agree with this.
Well, you're branded as a nominal Christian.
Right.
I mean, those are their words. That, of course, the attack on sort of a liberal, tolerant Christianity, which has been going on now for almost three decades, is very far advanced. I mean, the Dominionists have taken control of the Southern Baptist Convention. They've split churches like the Episcopal Church. My own church, the Presbyterian Church, is beset with this.
The Lutheran Church is under attack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
how do we deal with this? How do we respond? How do we as Americans respond to this, of all Americans of all faiths and Americans of no faith whatsoever? This country was founded as a secular democratic republic, not as a religious institution. How do we respond to this?
Well, I begin the book with this quote from Karl Popper's The Open Society and Its Enemies about the danger of tolerating the intolerant. That when we tolerate the intolerant, then eventually tolerance, along with the tolerant, disappear. And, these people have set up closed information systems through Christian radio and broadcasting where people are hermetically encased in this ideology. They get their news, their spiritual belief, their entertainment, all comes through this frightening prism and pumped forth with this message is incredible bigotry, not only towards gays and lesbians and Muslims, but to anybody who is not submissive to this movement. And that's one of the reasons why the Christian right works so hard to fight hate crimes legislation, because they know just on the issue of gays and lesbians they could be silenced. And I think there has to be a way that we break these these closed information systems, and they and originally, as you know, the National Religious Broadcasters was formed because Franklin Delano Roosevelt did not want to turn the airwaves over to Christian bigots.
Yeah. Now you have and then the whole experience of Father Coughlin, who turned on Roosevelt in midstream. I mean, he originally supported Roosevelt and then turned against him. Pat Robertson sold his empire for about $1 billion, as I recall, or it's worth $1 billion, the Christian Broadcasting Network. What about just pulling the tax-exempt status of these groups?
Well, I think they're very vulnerable on a couple points. I mean, one, of course, in a democratic society, going after them for the kind of bigotry and intolerance they incite. But I think you're also right that, how did Pat Robertson build his empire? He built it by essentially taking donations from, I think, manipulated and gullible believers.
Well, and selling milkshakes and food supplements.
Selling milkshakes. But the 700 Club was originally, I need 700 people to sort of fund this.
Right.
These people have amassed, we don't know how much he's worth, anywhere from, 400 or 500 to $1 billion plus. These people have amassed hundreds of millions of dollars, and there's no accountability at all.
Yeah. This is absolute must reading. Check it out. It's called The American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America by Chris Hedges. Also the author of Losing Moses on the Freeway, which I found to be just an extraordinarily wonderful book as well. Chris Hedges, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back. And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. What are the things that you would most like to see Congress investigate? We should start creating a list, David. It could be a pretty long one. Today in the news, a U.S. sub collides with Japanese ship. Right? This is a CNN report. A U.S. submarine has collided with a Japanese merchant vessel, a senior U.S. Navy official told CNN. USS Newport News was surfacing in the Arabian Sea south of the Straits of Hormuz when it hit the Japanese ship, the official said. That's interesting. I've sailed through that area. There were no injuries, he said, but there was some damage. Neither ship is in extremis, the official said late Monday local time in Washington, D.C., meaning the damage was not serious enough to put the ships in jeopardy. And now we get to the part where I would sure like to see an investigation of this. I mean, I think this really warrants it. Back in 2001, February 9th, 2001, to be exact, this very day in 2001, there were some civilians on board a U.S. nuclear submarine, the USS Greenville. And according to some reports, now again, this has never been investigated, but according to some reports, these were large corporate donors to the Republican Party, including some people from Enron, and control of the U.S. nuclear submarine was given to them, and one of them surfaced it too quickly, and it hit the ship Ehime Maru, the Japanese ship, and killed 9 people, including 4 high school students. And it's, as I said, it has never been investigated. There's never been a public investigation. The administration was very competent at quickly shutting it down, and the Democrats had no ability to do an investigation. I think we ought to be looking back on that. What happened? What happened on this day in 2001? When the USS Greenville struck this Japanese ship and killed 9 people. And why did we turn a nuclear submarine over to Republican campaign contributors? Carol in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE on the line. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today? Carol?
Hello?
Yes, you are on the air.
Yes, I was calling in because my son is U.S. Marine. He's in flight school.
And on the base that he's learning how to fly, Lockheed Martin actually is contracted to run this base. And recently in a risk assessment class, the first 15 minutes of the class was on risk assessment, and the remaining hour was on Bible study. And my son was thoroughly disgusted by this. He's trying to learn how to fly safely, and he's being taught Bible study on a base.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, there is a concerted effort by this fringe movement. I call them Christianists, you know, like Islamists. They believe that we should have a state that is run by a religious few, and they will decide who will be the ones who will run it, and somehow they'll figure out who God put in charge. And these Christianists believe that the way to do this is to take over the military, and they're doing it.
It was way over the top stuff too. Like he said, the Arabs are the sons of Hagar, and that their mission as pilots was to annihilate these people.
Whoa!
So it was very, very fringe stuff.
And this was put forward by
a retired Marine colonel who was supposed to be teaching a risk assessment class.
Holy cow! And you said what's Lockheed Martin's role in this?
Lockheed Martin is contracted to run the base because our bases are being privatized, and I don't think many people know that.
Yeah, but that's not, you know.
They hired the guy, the Lockheed Martin.
Oh, they did. So they have some control over the content.
Yes, I'm not sure that Lockheed Martin is aware that this is what his curriculum is, but it was supposed to be a risk assessment class, and that was what he was hired to do.
That's absolutely remarkable. Well, it's consistent with, I mean, you read Chris Hedges' book, and it's not the only one. There's a number of them out there, and, you know, we've talked about this on this program. I am firmly and strongly believe that faith and even religion, even organized religion, can be good things and forces for good. But when they rise up and try to take over government, it becomes very, very dangerous and very, very toxic. And there's a long history of that. And trying to take over the United States government by taking over the military from within is absolutely spooky to me. Carol, thanks for the heads up.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Robert in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening in WPTT. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon. It's great to talk to a great American.
Well, thank you. I think.
I was listening to James Dobson, and he was convincingly patting Bush on the back for something called the anti-stem cell research thing. And I called because I want to know what your take on how Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell have all influenced the world.
My sense is that Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell have had a net negative influence on the world. What specifically are you wondering about?
Well, for example, Jerry Falwell has Liberty University, and he says, you're not going to believe this, one of his speakers he had that was Sean Hannity.
Sure.
And I was like, what?
Well, no, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson have a long history of mixing religion and politics. I mean, when Hurricane Katrina happened, there were two charities on the FEMA website, the Federal Emergency Management Agency website, that you could click on to give money to help out the folks in Katrina. One of them was the American Red Cross, and the other was Operation Blessing, which is Pat Robertson's operation. I mean, you know, these are the guys who said, well, this is a conversation between Robertson and Falwell the day after 9/11.
That I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
I totally concur. The problem is we've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
See, now this was the beginning of the declaration of war on our judiciary, and we've seen now Roberts and Alito in part as a consequence of that. And then also they went on to say that we deserved 9/11. Here's Falwell and Robertson again.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if, in fact, if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Gary, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
See, and these guys are put on mainstream media continuously as representatives of Christian America. And in my opinion, they are not representatives of Christian America. They are representatives of a small right-wing fringe that is attempting to take over Christianity, is attempting to take over the United States government, much to the detriment of American democracy, and frankly, much to the detriment of Christianity, Robert.
Okay, what was I going to bring up? Have you ever heard of the Reverend Jim Wallace?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I just don't understand why he's not on the air and why you got these nitwits like Robinson and Falwell on the air.
Yeah, well, there's a whole broad spectrum of opinions out there, I thought that Wallace was another one of the right wingers. He's one of the more rational voices.
I think it was something for the Democrats early 2005.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some very rational voices, you know, People United for the Separation of Church and State, that organization and its leader. I mean, there are some good and rational voices out there, but they're few and far between. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you, and I appreciate your listening to the program. I mean, this is the ongoing thing, and in fact, you know, even Bush starts bringing this stuff in. I mean, his speech before the RNC, just this short clip, notice the religious references over and over and over again in this, you know, sliced and diced montage from George Bush's speech to his own people at the Republican National Convention.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists.
Now, evil in and of itself, you know, a term that is typically religious in its context.
Danger. Doom killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God. Iraq. Darkness. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil. We are staying.
And, you know, it's enough already. But, you know, the point is that what we're seeing here is the reinvention of fundamentalism, not just in religion and not just in government, but right across the board in public life. And I think it's something that all Americans should be very concerned about. It's a fine thing for people to have a faith in religion and hold that in their homes and their churches in whatever form or way that they want. But when it gets into the public arena, when it threatens to take down civic institutions, then I think we have a really serious problem on our hands here. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. We'll be right back.
Who's on the hill and who's watching the valley? Who's in charge of it all? God bless the army and God bless our liberty. Jack up the rest of it all.
Hell, man, in position of backing away. Freedom is stuck in reverse.
Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and let's rebuild America first.
You tell them, Merle Haggard! Welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Just coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. Jim Wallace, folks in the chat room, quick to remind me. Sojourners, yes, of course, Sojourners Magazine. Sojourners, Jim Wallace, in fact, he's got a blog called God's Politics. Well, God's Politics is the title of his book. And his blog entry for today. In fact, he says, tomorrow evening, President Bush will speak to the country about his plan to send more U.S. troops to Iraq. The question is, where will they come from? The military is already overstretched. More troops means more casualties, more suffering for families, more losses of beloved ones. And without a new political strategy, a new military buildup that won't succeed. It's a very sad commentary on more incompetence and resulting insensitivity. Who will have the courage to lead us out of this disaster? Brilliantly said, Jim. And it's looking like perhaps who will have the courage is going to be Ted Kennedy and John Murtha. John Murtha is saying, no, I'm not going to have it. This was on Hardball yesterday with Chris Matthews.
I believe that we have to have hearings and force them to justify every cent. Then, in addition to that, we have to say, okay, what is the achievable plan? For instance, they sent in 10,000 troops two and a half, 3 months ago. Those 10,000 troops didn't do any good at all. There's more problems today than there were then. More people killed.
In fact, I would say when those 10,000 troops, you know, when we did our so-called surge in Baghdad, what we saw was an increase in American casualties, not to mention more dead Iraqis. And you get more dead Iraqis, and you get more dead, and you get more angry relatives. You get more angry relatives, you get more potential insurgents, more future insurgents. We're raising an entire generation of Iraqis to hate Americans. Not the way it should be. Jack Murtha continues talking with Chris Matthews.
So now we're going to send in another brigade, piecemeal. That's not going to solve the problem. I have not seen anything that assures me there's going to be any progress made in Iraq. And then the Iraqis have no incentive. They say they're going to have benchmarks. What are the benchmarks? What are we going to do if they don't meet these benchmarks?
Well, there's no measure. There's been, well, we'll see when Bush gives his speech. But I guarantee you the benchmarks are going to be ephemeral. It's going to be an absolute minimal thing. And now, you know, the debate is, I mean, you even have some Democrats saying this. Well, I'm not sure that we can tell the president what to do. After all, he's commander-in-chief. I'm sorry. The Constitution quite clearly says it's your job to tell the commander-in-chief, the president, what to do. And, in fact, every 2 years, if you're going to vote to have a war, every 2 years, you have to revisit that. The Constitution requires that you can't have funding for a war that lasts more than 2 years, period. There's actually a long history of specific pieces of legislation that constrained presidents. The Center for American Progress pulled together a list over the last 35, this is just over the last 35 years, and every single one of these was passed into law. In December of 1970, this is during the Vietnam War, Public Law 91-652. It's the Supplemental Foreign Assistance Law. It's called the Church-Cooper Amendment. It prohibited the use of any funds for the introduction of U.S. troops to Cambodia or to provide military advisors to Cambodian forces. In 74, December of 74, Public Law 93-559, Foreign Assistance Act of 1974 is what it was known as. The Congress established a personnel ceiling of 4,000 Americans in Vietnam within 6 months of enactment and 3,000 Americans within 1 year. A ceiling! They said you can't have more than 4,000 Americans within 6 months of the time we passed this law. You can't have more than 3,000 within a year. Fast forward 9 years to June of 1983. The Lebanon Emergency Assistance Act of 1983, Congress required the president to return to Congress to seek statutory authorization if he wanted to expand the size of the U.S. contingent of the multinational force in Lebanon. You're going to get us deeper into that mess? You're going to have to come back to Congress and ask for more money to do it. In June of 1984, the same thing, Public Law 98-525, the Defense Authorization Act. Congress capped the end strength level of U.S. forces assigned to permanent duty in European NATO countries at 324,400. I mean, this isn't even some big controversial, you know, war or something. This is just saying this is the maximum number of folks that we're going to be able to send, that you, the president, are going to send to cooperate with NATO. We have a treaty with them. And then in November of 1993, as a consequence of the whole Black Hawk Down thing, you've got the Republicans in control of the House. Actually, well, that was 94, wasn't it? So in any case, in November of 93, Congress limited the use of funding in Somalia for operations of U.S. military personnel only until March 31st, 1994, permitting expenditure of funds for the mission thereafter only if the president sought and Congress provided specific authorizations. And there's a whole long list of them over there. These are just the highlights, as it were, a whole long list of these things. So if the next time you hear some politician trying to weasel out of their responsibility by going, you know, being a talking head on one of these shows and saying, well, I don't know if we can micromanage what the president's going to do, just tell him, sorry, that's your job. tomorrow on our program. Top news of the day. Plus, conservative Gary Sutton is going to drop by with the 7 Walmart objections. He thinks they're funny. We'll see. In Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Emma Mellon is going to tell us, what do your dreams really tell you? That and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy and activism, they both begin with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.